Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, September 19th, 2016. Over the weekend, a lot of news broke. And my lead story today is how the Washington Post has soiled itself. With an editorial calling for the prosecution of the source that won them a Pulitzer Prize. It is shocking. And of course, the guy they want prosecuted is Edward Snowden. I haven't seen any box office numbers about how well the Oliver Stone biopic has done over the weekend, but I hope many of my listeners took the opportunity to go see it. Because, with, you know, the typical Hollywood caveats, I think it does a good job of explaining who Ed Snowden is, what his motives were, and that he doesn't deserve the kind of lies and smears that are being promoted in his direction. And on Sunday, I picked up on a couple of threads. Glenn Greenwald has broken his silence about the Snowden movie, and I explained that it's a contractual thing. Greenwald wrote a book about Snowden. It got picked up by a studio that hasn't made a film yet. So he was kind of aced out of the Oliver Stone loop. But he has really crucified the Washington Post, and they deserved every nail. What he points out is that there are four major media outlets that publish Snowden documents: The Guardian, The New York Times, Greenwald's outlet called The Intercept, and The Washington Post. And three of the four have editorialized in favor of a pardon or other accommodation for Ed Snowden so he can return to the United States and not simply be faced with a Chelsea Manning future. But Greenwald writes, not The Washington Post. In the face of a growing campaign to secure a pardon for Snowden, the Post editorial page not only argued in opposition to a pardon, but explicitly demanded that Snowden, the paper's own source, stand trial on espionage charges or, as a second-best solution, accept a measure of criminal responsibility for his excesses. Quoting Greenwald further, in doing so, the Post has achieved an ignominious feat in U.S. media history, the first ever paper to explicitly editorialize for the criminal prosecution of its own source, one on whose back the paper won and eagerly accepted a Pulitzer Prize for public service. This is a new low in hypocrisy. And if you'll pardon my French, it's really fucked up. And Greenwald goes on to explain that Ed Snowden didn't publish anything. It was the editors of the Washington Post that made decisions to publish information based on the leaks of Ed Snowden. And so there is a divide between the reporters, and we're going to quote Bart Gellman liberally here in a moment, one of the lead writers at the Washington Post, who handled the Snowden articles for the most part, for that paper. And so this piles on with the smears that were released in the Friday letter from the House Intelligence Committee. And we'll get to the Barton Gellman response to that in a moment. But they're very concerned that the public is going to figure out that it's the government that's wrong and not Ed Snowden. And the Washington Post, now under the control of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, is lurching into more of a pro-statist position, and that's hard to achieve because the Post has always been a pretty willing collaborator with whoever is in power in Washington at the moment. And here's a specific example. If the Post editorial page editors, I'm quoting Greenwald, really believe that PRISM was a totally legitimate program and no public interest was served by its exposure, shouldn't they be attacking their own paper's news editors for having chosen to make it public, apologizing to the public for harming their security, and agitating for a return of the Pulitzer? So, I give Greenwald credit for his sharp and brutal analysis of this bizarre statement, and it's not the first. Linda Lewis, who's a regular listener and a real contributor to my Facebook feed, and let me just plug Facebook. It's got a lot of problems, and I don't like all the pet pictures and people who post their breakfast or their lunch. But my contributors on my news feed are a lot of smart and well-informed people like Linda Lewis. And so I welcome you to send me a friend request at Facebook. Address it to Peter B. Collins Show. And I post every new show there every day, and you're welcome to comment on it there. But it's just another way to participate in the community that I've tried to create with the Peter B. Collins podcast. So, Linda, I appreciate your comments, and she linked us to a previous editorial the Post ran, which is similarly schizoid. and yes, you know, I do appreciate that there is a divide between the news department and the editorial department. But when they're working at obviously opposite ends, well, the final line of Greenwald's piece is, that is warped beyond anything that can be described. And, of course, we know that the Washington Post, along with the New York Times, is one of the most reliable leakers for official Washington. You're in the Pentagon, you're in the Cabinet, you're in the White House, you're on Capitol Hill, and you want to see something leaked out that you don't want attributed to you? They'll play ball. You don't have to go to WikiLeaks. No, you just call somebody over at the Post and or the Times, and they'll be right there. And this editorial is kind of Trump-like, where the editors appear to be able to dismiss the excellent reporting that occasionally gets published in the news columns of the same paper on critical national issues. And they're sucking up to the police state and the deep state is something that is aggressively obvious. And I use the word aggressively in order to segue into this brilliant piece that Bart Gellman wrote. And I've interviewed Bart a couple of times. He is a very bright guy, and he's very honest. He's a dedicated reporter. And he described the Intelligence Committee's letter sent to the White House urging no pardon or other accommodation for Ed Snowden as an aggressively dishonest piece of work. And this committee went public with this. It's alleged to be a 3-page executive summary of a 36-page report. Now, the report is classified. They spent 2 years on this. We don't know what it says, but their summation is that it's all Ed Snowden's fault. And, of course, they're busy circling wagons to protect the interests of the national surveillance state. So I'm going to briefly go through this, but I want you to read Bart Gellman's piece, because he just, you know, line by line, takes down the most egregious elements of this letter from the Intelligence Committee. One of the ways they try to undermine him is by calling him a serial exaggerator and fabricator. Quote, he claimed to have left Army basic training because of broken legs, when in fact he washed out because of shin splints. And Gellman writes, this is verifiably false for anyone who, as the committee asserts, performs a close review of Snowden's official employment records. And Gellman says he has reviewed those records and that the diagnosis that led to his discharge was bilateral tibial stress fractures. Fractures. These are not shin splints or other things like, you know, the way Rush Limbaugh or Dick Cheney got out of the draft. Okay, next item. He claimed to have obtained a high school degree equivalent when, in fact, he never did. Gellman, I don't know how the committee could get this wrong. According to the official Maryland State Department of Education test report, he scored very high on the high school equivalent and got his diploma on June 2nd of 2004. Next claim from the Intel Committee. He said he worked for the CIA as a senior advisor, which is a gross exaggeration of his entry-level duties as a computer technician. And Gellman notes the three main roles that Snowden played at the CIA. First, an entry-level position. After that, he was selected for, given special training in classified technology. Then they deployed him to Geneva under diplomatic cover, complete with a false name. In his third CIA job, the title on his Dell business card was Solutions Consultant Cyber Referent. And in that role, he met regularly with chiefs and deputy chiefs of the CIA's technical branches. That's not a low-level analyst. And, as I think it was Jason Leopold who remarked, but I agreed, the Oliver Stone film shows that pretty clearly. They say he doctored his performance evaluations. And what in fact he did was demonstrate to a superior how he could hack into the CIA's human resources intranet, that's not on the internet, intranet, and make changes in his own file. He did it as a demonstration in front of a superior. Then, in May 2013, Snowden informed his supervisor that he would be out of the office to receive treatment for worsening epilepsy. In reality, he was on his way to Hong Kong with stolen secrets. Wow, they really nailed him on this one. So the fact that Snowden lied about why he was leaving this Booz Allen Hamilton cave in Hawaii, this is supposed to reflect badly on his honesty and integrity. And then we get to the issue of whether he did any damage. And Bart Gellman writes, I believe Snowden's disclosures did a lot more good than harm, but I don't share the view of some of his fans that he did no damage at all. Well, I think it's hard to evaluate that, but my general notion is that Gellman is right. Maybe there were a few things that have been compromised as a result of Ed Snowden. But to say that he caused the greatest breach in American security in history, that's a flat-out lie. And Gellman cites the Hansen case, just about 17 years ago. And I really applaud Glenn Greenwald and Bart Gellman, not for defending Snowden, but for fighting for the truth, and for being willing to call out powerful people like those on the House Intelligence Committee, and Bart Gellman needs them as sources for future reporting, but he has the courage to call it as he sees it. And last night, as I was fixing dinner, I had the boob tube on, and I watched the CBS weekend news, and then I watched part of 60 Minutes. The weekend news had a 10-minute segment. No, it wasn't that long. It was about a 3-minute piece. There was pure puffery about the Secret Service, talking about how they'll take a bullet for the president and all this bullshit. And there was nothing about the scandals of the Secret Service in recent years. It is a rogue agency. It's riddled with insider cronyism, and they protect each other when they break the law or get drunk or go see a prostitute. None of that made it into the CBS report. Then a lengthier story that was on 60 Minutes about the Strategic Command. It only included one critical example of a failure at the Strategic Command that was more than 25 years ago. Well, it's more than 20. It was during the first Clinton administration. There was a false order to launch missiles, and it was canceled before anything bad happened. Well, the Strategic Command has been riddled with scandals in recent years. But CBS runs these stories. Why? Because it greases their government sources, who will then leak to them in the future. They'll get the exclusive story and be able to brag about it. But it's not journalism. It's not journalism. Over the weekend, we learned that an American fighter, I guess it was a fighter jet followed up by another plane, two F-16s and two A-10s, carried out 4 strikes against an airbase in Syria. And I've seen aerial photos that make it pretty clear that this is controlled by the Syrian military. The U.S. says, oops, we were trying to bomb Islamic State positions near the airport. But as many as 80 or more Syrian soldiers were killed. And this occurred during the ceasefire engineered by the United States. And that ceasefire had, fingers crossed, the ceasefire was to stop the Syrians from fighting from the air. But the United States, it was able to continue to strike Islamic State positions. And we're saying, whoops, it was just a mistake. And as soon as the Russians pointed it out to us, we stopped. And then the Russians called a rare Saturday night meeting of the UN Security Council. And this apparently conflicted with the social life of our UN ambassador, Samantha Power. Because she was pissed and she was just spitting bullets or broken glass when she talked. And she said that while the U.S. apologizes, that Russia is conducting a stunt by convening the Security Council. And our friend and colleague Joe Lauria, who covers the United Nations, had some excellent commentary on Facebook, just saying that he thinks she's really lost it. And that this certainly, as the foreplay for this week's UN General Assembly, and of course it's the confab of the Bill Clinton Global Initiative, New York's going to be busy, and the U.S., which is trying to put together a package for support of Syrian and other Middle East refugees, is going to have a hard time with a lame duck president, a foreign policy that's in tatters. We're constantly being won up by the Russians. And the idea that we can still take out Assad and vanquish the Islamic State and not have a failed state that will become some sort of authoritarian regime or desperate and despotic government. It's just so foolish. So it's going to be quite a ride in New York this week. And next Monday is the first presidential debate with Hillary and Donald, and it is sealed. Jill Stein and Gary Johnson are not invited to participate in the presidential debate. There's no surprise for me there. The whole presidential debate system is set up to exclude third-party candidates, and it's working. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Cheryl Fleming, Dick Attlee, Mark Brodsky, Jeffrey Stewart. You're all very important to me, and I'm grateful that you continue to support us. Every now and then people cancel their subscriptions, and I don't ask why. There's no pressure. And I'm sure some of it is because you've been offended by some opinion that I have offered. And that comes with the territory. I accept it. So I need some people to replace some recently departed subscribers. How about you? Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull it down, then you click on Become a Subscriber. And on the next page, you can sign up through PayPal. You can also mail in a check or cash or money order if you don't like PayPal. We don't force you to use it if you don't want to. And then you're a subscriber. And on the bonus page, on the sign-up page, I've got the current bonus books listed. And I still don't have someone who's opened up a new annual subscription and requested Revolution's End, the Brad Schreiber review of the SLA and Patty Hearst saga. And I also have one copy of America's War for the Middle East, and that's by Andrew Basevich. So for a new annual subscriber, pick one of those books, and if you're the first, I'll be happy to send it to you. Well, still in the Middle East with the war that never ends, I have made it my task this year to alert you to lame duck mission creep. And while we're all distracted by the latest bizarre ravings of Donald Trump, and they're too numerous to even recap the last 3 days for you, the Obama administration is taking advantage of the basic lack of interest by most Americans in our wars in the Middle East. So on Friday, it was announced that American special forces will be deployed to northern Syria to help clear Islamic State towns, embedded with Turkish forces. Now, maybe they're there just to keep the Turks from shooting Turkish Kurds. Maybe they are adult supervision. But this is just further expansion of the deployment of American troops. Now, the total number, as far as we know, has not increased in recent weeks. It's about 4,300 total between Syria and Iraq. But we've been told that they're just there to train, advise, and assist. But we know this puts Americans in harm's way, and if they get wounded or killed, this can become the casus belli, the reason why we've got to commit large numbers of troops. And as I mentioned, there are 4,000 there now, and Hillary Clinton said at the Commander-in-Chief Forum that you can count on her. She will never again deploy large numbers of American troops to Iraq and Syria. Well, can we believe that? So American special forces in the region so far have mostly embedded with the Syrian Democratic Forces. an Orwellian name of mostly Kurdish fighters. Those units at different times faced a three-front fight against the Islamic State, forces loyal to President Assad, and the Turkish military. The U.S. commandos embedded in those units are so close to the fighting that airstrikes on the Kurdish forces have come dangerously close to hitting American forces. And if you accept the Pentagon's claim that the airbase raid that killed more than 80 Syrians was a mistake, well, you need to know that that mistake is used by people in the region to promote the view that the United States is actually supporting the Islamic State. And I have to say, there's enough evidence to back up that claim that it can't be dismissed as just propaganda from the Syrian state TV or something that is concocted. There's a lot of evidence that is very confusing and leaves you wondering who's on what side and what is the U.S. role there. Well, I took personal interest in the Manhattan bombings that took place over the weekend, because one of them occurred two blocks from my stepson David's apartment. Fortunately, he was out of town, and so, personally, I didn't have to worry too much about it. Now, here on Monday, the FBI has announced the arrest of Ahmad Khan Rahami, a New Jersey resident who is an American naturalized citizen and who was born in Afghanistan. He's about 28 years old. And they found him sleeping on the doorstep of a bar in Linden, New Jersey. And there was a little bit of a skirmish. Rahami pulled out a gun. He shot the officer, but the bulletproof vest protect him, and the officer fired back. They hit him several times, and he was then taken into custody, still alive. And we don't know too much about him, except that he was identified by officials on surveillance video when he planted the bombs in Chelsea, both the device that exploded on 23rd Street and another that did not detonate a few blocks away. Now, one story I've heard, I can't prove this, is that that second one that didn't detonate, it's because he used a rolling suitcase, and some local criminals saw the suitcase. They said, okay, we're going to take it. And they removed the pressure cooker and the cell phone that would become an improvised device or bomb, and just left it there. And apparently that is what caused it not to go off. That shows you in many cases that people who just, go about their daily activities, even nefarious ones, can often do more to protect us than the entire national security state, the FBI, and all that goddamn surveillance. So what is interesting here is the New York Times today has a story that runs four or five pages when I printed it out. And there is not a single mention of prior contact between Rahami and the FBI or a paid FBI undercover informant. What we do learn is that the Rahamis, father and son, they have a restaurant called First American Fried Chicken that's open 24 hours a day, and that has made it into a hangout. There have been some complaints and effort to shut it down, and Rahami's older brother reportedly got into a dispute with police, and rather than face charges, he exited to Afghanistan. So we'll wait for more details on this story, but I'm relieved that no one was killed. And we also saw a certain amount of restraint. Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio both called it terrorism, but they at least censored themselves if they were thinking that it was international or Islamic terrorism. So we'll wait for more evidence to come in. Last week, I reported with some concern on the move by the chancellor at the University of California, Berkeley, to suspend a course, a student-led course, called Palestine, a Settler Colonial Analysis. And I brought you an interview with Lisa Hajar, who is a professor at UC Santa Barbara, and we aired out some of those issues. And Hajar sent me a open letter written by the Committee on Academic Freedom of the Middle East Studies Association of North America, And it's an excellent letter. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast. A couple of quotes. "We are distressed by the assertion in the official announcement of the suspension that the dean is very concerned about a course, even a student-run course, which espouses a single political viewpoint and or appears to offer a forum for political organizing. Well, as such," the letter says, "we are concerned that this particular course was suspended only because outside pressure groups objected to it on political grounds, and that the language used by the university inappropriately conflates the critical study of Israel-Palestine with anti-Semitism." And I agree with that analysis. And the letter goes on to say that the suspension was announced because it allegedly intended, the course allegedly intended to indoctrinate students to hate the Jewish state and take action to eliminate it. Well, that is an exaggeration that is so far away from the facts that you can dismiss it as pure fantasy. But it is that kind of argument that's gaining traction, and the power of Zionist interests in this country and the complicity of elected officials is really producing a very, very concerning restriction on a specific type of speech in the United States. So I've just learned that an investigation into claims of anti-Semitism at the City University of New York, America's top, largest urban public university, has been found to be completely without basis. So they investigated claims going back to February after the Zionists of America wrote a scathing letter accusing local chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine of creating a hostile campus environment for Jewish students at CUNY. And they've been campaigning against SJP for years. So what's going on is that Palestine Legal and the Center for Constitutional Rights have documented what they call a Palestine exception to free speech. And that's what is really at the center of all this. They are trying to stifle free speech, claiming that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic and therefore out of bounds. And the report, conducted by a former federal prosecutor and a former federal judge, concluded that those who call for boycotts and divestment against Israel should not be tarred as anti-Semitic. And it also stated that banners that use the depictions of a keffiyeh, the Palestinian scarf, are protected speech. Now, I want to be fair. They do acknowledge that there have been episodes of anti-Semitic expression, but they are not directly linked to Students for Justice in Palestine. And this article makes the point, and by the way, the article is from the Jewish newspaper, The Forward, okay? That's my source here, and I've linked to it, so you can read this as well. It noted that a Brooklyn SJP leader had also been the victim of an Islamophobic incident, and that no fair-minded person would blame that on the Israeli student group Hillel, and therefore SJP shouldn't be judged in the same faulty manner. Well, Donald Trump has committed another act of paralipsis. If you remember a couple of weeks ago, I told you about this term. A guy wrote about it in the Huff Post. And paralipsis is where you say that you're not going to do something as you essentially do it. And so over the weekend, Donald Trump tweeted that his lawyers want to sue the New York Times, but he has said no for now. So it's an attempt at intimidation by saying, I'm not going to intimidate you legally, I'm just going to threaten you verbally with legal action. Why? Well, on Saturday, the New York Times released an investigative piece that showed that the Donald has enjoyed almost $1 billion worth of tax breaks from New York City related to the properties that he owns there. It's $885 million over a period of time. And they focus on the Hyatt that he refurbished next to Grand Central Station. And that deal, an extraordinary 40-year tax break, has cost New York City $360 million in forgiven or uncollected taxes on a property that cost only $120 million to build back in 1980. And it shows that he uses Jews, he used his father's influence, Mayor Ed Koch, Hugh Carey, a former mayor, I think, is one of his allies. And so This just shows that Trump is a guy who's been a leech off the public, who manages to whipsaw government officials into giving him huge tax breaks. And he's the guy who wants to be our president. Now, this one was a stunner, too, and I want to cite the source. It comes from The Observer, and I've explained to you that The Observer is owned by Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law. Still, if you kind of, filter out some of the polemic in this article, I think I've linked to it, I will, in the show file for today's podcast, it shows a really disturbing pattern that the Clinton campaign will receive a $25 donation from an individual, and then they will charge additional contributions to that person's credit card without their permission. And they do it right up to a level under $100 because they know that the banks don't pursue claims of under $100. Now, you may ask, well, maybe this happens once in a while, but according to this article, and there's no citation given, somebody at the fraud department of one of the nation's biggest banks receives up to 100 phone calls a day from Clinton's small donors asking for refunds for unauthorized charges. Now, keep in mind, there's no source for that. But another source attributed to working for Wells Fargo for over 10 years said that the total amount that they return to customers who've been overcharged by the Clinton campaign varies between $700 and $1,200 a day. And the story also profiles an 81-year-old grandmother from Minnesota who is one of the victims of the campaign. In March, she made a one-time $25 donation, and then when she got her bank card statement, she noticed multiple $25 charges were made, and her son, a lawyer, is one of the people who exposed this. Jason Leopold never stops. He's published a new article based on a successful lawsuit against the government under the Freedom of Information Act to win release of federal documents related to what are called pen registers and trap and trace devices. Now, these are relate to old technology. A pen register and trap and trace were devices used by law enforcement to track phone calls before we had caller ID and the collection of all our metadata by the NSA. And the government authorities have tried to use that old authority where they said, well, look, we didn't listen to the calls. We just tracked who called when and where and where they called from. And they're using that authority now to justify the deployment of the Stingray. Stingray, of course, is this device that just sucks up all of the cell phone data within range, including mostly innocent people. And courts have claimed, oh, the pen register law is the precedent that allows us to do this. But we know that Stingray can actually access the data, listen to your calls, save your contacts. It does much more than just capturing the traffic to and from your phone. And this took 3 years. I credit Jason Leopold for his dogged persistence on these cases. And so, in short order, we expect that the government will be releasing data related to the use of these techniques. And finally, today, I just want to share an item with you. On Friday, I learned that one of the men released from Guantanamo to Uruguay, whose name is Diab, D-H-I-A-B, he was a hunger striker who put his life on the line at Gitmo to hopefully pressure for his release. Well, he was released to Uruguay, where he's very unhappy. He has not been reunited with his family. He's just parked there. So Diab has launched a new hunger strike. And that triggered a recall in my mind because there is a long-running effort to force the government to release videotapes of the force-feeding of prisoners at Guantanamo. And our longtime colleague, John Eisenberg, is the attorney, one of them, who's been handling that effort. And he responded to my request for an update with this. You may recall that Judge Gladys Kessler ordered public release of the videos as substantially redacted by the government, and the government appealed the order. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments on September 8th. I think it likely the Court of Appeals will reverse Judge Kessler and the videos will never see daylight. And that, of course, is just another effort from the most transparent administration in American history. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening to my news and comment. This podcast is free, and it's available daily on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.